their reindeer breeding districts. I wouldn't be able to say now to what extent this is an exclusive right, but that it is there is for certain, that it can be checked in reference literature.
In the political program adopted by the Sami, you say that they are asking for their own institutions of self-government. I think I understood it that way. Are they asking for any preference regarding taking fish and game? Is that a matter that is of importance to them?
I would say that the possibility to fish and hunt is of big importance to many Sami communities. But there has been a process of resource extermination of the wildlife and the life in the river due to external exploitation. So that in some areas, the traditional habits of fishing and hunting have been deteriorating. We see, however, that there is a very great potential for restoring and even modernizing the potential which lies in hunting, fishing, and trapping as a part of the natural economy, and we could even say as a part of the modern economy of the Sami area. So I would say it is a general wish that the possibility to protect and to cultivate the potential for hunting and fishing is a definite part of Sami policy. And our institute has even done some studies to which extent this is a part of the common notion of Sami local population.
David Case, you have a question.
Mr. Cascatello, Mr. O'Neill referred to the importance, as I understood it, and the reality of the support of the majority population when it came to the adoption of the 1967 referendum on the Australian Constitution. I wonder if you could comment on the degree to which you perceive support among the majority populations of these three countries, Finland and Sweden and Norway, as distinguished from government support for those desires. To what extent do you perceive the populations, the majority populations, supporting Sami interests and perspectives?
There are probably two things to be said about this. The first thing is that the support in the majority population seems to be conjunctural. It seems to follow waves of media interest and the frequency of more or less dramatic events. When dramatic things are happening, the population as a general public seems to a large portion to be sympathetic to Sami claims. But the other thing that is to be said about this is that that concerns the general public in those areas which are not immediately in contact with the Sami population. In the northern provinces, there is, of course, a strong political polarization of opinion in the majority population. as to what are to be recognized as Sami rights and what are legitimate claims on behalf of the Sami population. But I would say that the last 2 or 3 years has shown a definite glide or progress in the opinion of the general public, even in the north. Also, in the papers of the big political parties. That there is a process going on in benefit of Sami claims, I would think is not possible to doubt. And that it gets out of a sort of conjunctural state into a more stable, solid opinion in the population.
Mark Gordon, you had a question.
Yes, my question relates to the movement of the Sami people between the different nation states. The first part is you said that some people would move from one nation state to the other within a year with their natural movements back and forth. Do those people have what we would consider like dual citizenship, or are they declared a Norwegian because they were born in Norway, or how does this work? That's my first question.
No. Those who move regularly between nation states are not a very considerable part of the Sami population. But there are reindeer breeders who move annually back and forth across the border of Norway and Sweden. And this is possible due to a convention between Norway and Sweden that is effective up to 2002, I think. All Samis are citizens in a particular country, either in Norway, Sweden, Finland, or even the Soviet Union. But there is no restriction on moving across the borders. But that's a restriction that is not imposed on any citizen in the Nordic countries. That means that the area of Norway, Sweden, Finland, Denmark is a passport union and a labor market union. So the absence of restrictions is a contingent fact relating to the whole Nordic population and not only to the Sami population as such.
My other question related to the Soviet Union. The Inuit have a fairly similar problem. We're living in 3 Western countries, and then there's also a portion of the population which is in the Soviet Union. I'm just interested in how much contact is allowed and how much movement is allowed between, let's say, the Sami from Finland and the ones in the Soviet Union.
Well, there has been contact between the Samis in Finland and the Soviet Union. It has even had some sort of official niveau. There has been delegations from the Finnish Sami organizations to the Kola Peninsula, and there has been guest relationship back. However, it has been almost impossible to get a permanent cooperation across the borders to the Soviet Union. The Nordic Sami Council has invited the Samis in the Soviet Union to participate in the Nordic Sami Conference. So far, there has been no delegation from the Samis in the Soviet Union. There have been linguists and scientists from Russian universities attending these conferences as observers, but no, so far, no official or unofficial Sami delegation from the Soviet Union.
Shorty O'Neill?
Alf, we recognize the struggle to stop dams and mines and many other things happening on our land as an intricate part of sovereignty and land rights, because once you get your land back and somebody's built a dam on it, it's not much good to you if it's all underwater. So it is a very important part of the struggle for recognition of sovereignty and land rights. And I was wondering if you could fill us in a bit on the struggles that were going in the north of stopping those dams that were coming up, and I believe there were a couple of mines that were going to open up there. If you could fill us in on some of that.
Yeah, did I understand you right? Do you want me to tell more about?
Yeah, the struggle movements on the stopping the dams, yes, being built in the north to a lot of hydroelectric schemes. And on both the north of Norway and Sweden, where the Sami people had taken a fairly major role in the protest of stopping those dams going ahead. If you could bring us up currently on what's happening there.
Well, roughly what has happened in this concrete case, in the Alta case, that twice in 1979 and in 1981 there were hunger strikes carried through by Samis in the capital of Norway in order to get the government to realize that there was a very acute question of Sami land rights involved, and that the consequences of the river dam would be considerable on the reindeer breeding in the area. There were also demonstrations in the actual road building and dam area by both Samis and Norwegian environmentalists. In both cases, the government had to put in a police force of a considerable amount, up to 600 policemen, in order to carry away those who were demonstrating and just sitting down on the road and linking themselves to stones and the ground. There was also an occupation of the Prime Minister's office by Sami women. The first Norwegian Prime Minister, who was a woman, happened to be newly elected into office at that time. So one of her first jobs were to try to negotiate with Sami women who were sitting down in her own office. It's no doubt that the acute and sudden action that was taken in the hunger strikes and in the, I said, peaceful demonstrations at the Alta River bank accelerated the obligation of the government to comply to Sami claims and to their own stated promises. And It's just a very sad fact that in such developments it seems that something of a dramatic character has to enter the scene before the government seems to be willing to comply to what it has stated itself, in fact. And well, our hope is that we, as the people in the three Nordic countries, will be able to live there peacefully. And our hope is also that the Nordic governments will be able to evaluate what sort of protection we really need in order to be able to live peacefully and to be peaceful, because that's what we really want. Yes.
Bill Erasmus.
I'd like to, you mentioned some, you made mention of the political aspirations of the Sami. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that? You mentioned that you want recognition of Sami land rights, land title, and that you have some type of representation within the democratic system, but I was not clear on what you meant by that. Could you elaborate a little bit on your political aspirations, please?
I'll try that. First of all, of course, Sami people as individuals are able to participate in the ordinary democratic process in the Nordic countries. But in such a way, one is mostly bound by the political parties' programs and will have to work considerably hard to be able to get Sami matters as to be central questions in the democratic process. What we want, broadly, is to say to take the consequences of what democracy really is in the Nordic countries and claim not only the individual rights, but the right of being a people with a certain self-determination. And that means that we want the officiality of identity. By that I mean we want as group and individual to be able to have an official status as a Sami person, so to say have a Sami passport, because that's what we are. We are Samis. We are not Norwegians, Swedes, Finns, Russians, and so on. And the second thing is that we want to take the democratic consequence to that and have the right to elect our own political organs to represent us towards the government and to regulate matters among ourselves to an extent that must be a result of the democratic process itself. In the debate in the Sami organizations, it has been very put stress on the fact that, in fact, we are not allowed to formulate any precise policy in relation to, for instance, land rights before we have an elected representative body. It must be the elected representative body that is to take up the questions and be in any sense allowed to formulate a precise policy of land rights. The organization of which I'm a member, for instance, the Norwegian Sami Association, would probably say that it in itself is not entitled to, so to say, sell away or formulate which type of land rights are relevant, because we might risk to be doing something very wrong by trying to formulate or represent a view on land rights, for instance, that not everybody in the Sami population has been able to express a view on. We believe that if the democratic process is made consequent, then also every Sami person will have the opportunity, or a better opportunity than now, to influence the question of, for instance, the land rights process.
Do you envision some degree of sovereignty then? I'm not clear if you're advocating a system whereby you can work within the specific states that you live in, or if the Sami are saying that because of their collective nature, their historic background, etc., that you have specific sovereign rights that you would like recognized.
Yes. Of course, the fundamental opinion is that we have certain sovereign rights, if you like to call them like that, that we cannot lose. But we want, as it is formulated in the political program, we want that these sovereign rights cannot be modified or really formulated before it happens through a democratic process. Nobody can by itself, or by a more or less contingent voluntary organizations, be said to represent the people in this precise sense as an elected body would be able to say it does and do. And that at least is the point of view of the Sami political program and of the major Sami organizations, especially in Norway.
Rosita Worrell, sorry.
Yes, you made some reference to customary law, and that your customary law, I guess, in the early period, I don't know if it survived, and that's the question, is that your customary law regulated land use. In spite of the matriculation of your land, has that customary law prevailed?
Yeah. I can take two examples that might elucidate your question. In the connection with the 1751 border treaty, the countries Sweden and Denmark-Norway recognized the further existence of the Sami local court to execute customary law and probably even state law in this area to some extent. There were regular annual courts in the Cedars, up in the core area in the north. I'm not able presently to say how far that system was carried up in history. But it's quite clear that even when we get the transition to the ordinary court system, that some part of Sami customary law has been transferred into the decisions of local courts. And I'll mention one example. In my home district, quote again, or Kautokeino, it's been the custom for several hundred years to hunt ducks in the spring and not in the fall or autumn. Now, this is absolutely contrary to Norwegian law and hunting regulations. For what reason, I don't know. A Norwegian legislation seem to be saying that it's better to hunt duck in the fall than in the autumn. Well, one obvious reason for the Sami view might be that if one hunts ducks in the autumn, then one will hunt also the newborn ducks. And, well, I would not go into that more, but the fact is that local authorities in the northern province, for instance, so far has not tried to enforce Norwegian law on this point. And in my home community, where the policemen and the sheriff are Samis, do not enforce it. There is even a story when we are in the example of a Norwegian policeman recruited to the sheriff office at home, and he tried to use his nights hunting for duck hunters, with the result that the sheriff said that he should sleep at night and be able to do office work in the day. Well, thank you.
I think this might be a good time to break off the discussion for lunch and return at 1:30, and we'll carry on then. If there are any further questions for Alf Isaac Cascatella, we can put them to him at that time, and then we'll carry on with Robert Peterson from Greenland, and then we'll move on from there to Canada, and so we'll see you at 1:30.
They're not concerned about it. Everybody's treated as, I hope I'm right. Rick, there's no status, non-status in the in legal terms in the Northwest Territories, is there? Oh, okay. Well, if that's the answer, we'll get to that.
Well, we'll get underway again. And what I thought we would do this afternoon was, first of all, Sheldon Kachetag of the United Tribes of Alaska wishes to say a few words, and then we'll move on from there as planned. Sheldon, you have the floor, first of all.
Thank you, Mr. Berger. Appreciate the opportunity to be given to speak on behalf of the United Tribes of Alaska. And the first thing that I would like to do is to welcome all the distinguished guests who have appeared from various international positions throughout the world. This welcome is semi-official on behalf of the United Tribes of Alaska, our executive, our board, and our membership of 70-plus villages throughout Alaska. I would also like to extend this welcome to you on behalf of my fellow natives of Alaska. And I would also like to emphasize the fact that Anchorage is not Alaska. The Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was truly a landmark piece of legislation. For one thing, it recognizes the fact that we in Alaska have a valid and existing right to land which they have attempted to settle through the Claims Settlement Act. In going over all the documents which relate to land, tribes, and the relationship, I have come to the conclusion that the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act violates the sovereign right of tribal governments to stop the giving or taking away of lands, interest in lands, water rights, surface rights, you name it, without the consent of the tribe. And that is written in these constitutions, of which I have an example of the constitution of the native village of Unalakleet, of which I am a member. Article 4, Section 1, delineates the powers held by our village government as being, the village shall have the following powers: to do all things for the common good, which it has done or has had the right to do in the past; to deal with the federal and territorial governments on matters which interest the village; to stop any giving or taking away of village lands or other property without its consent. Now, it's my contention that the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, therefore, as it applies to my village, is not valid in all parts, because it was not taken to the village, to the IRA government in our village, for its consent. And therefore, as part of my welcome, I would like to tell you that we will be in the process of exercising our sovereign rights as a tribal government in declaring that the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, in all parts relating to our village and our interest in lands surrounding our village, will be null and void as far as our village is concerned. And I had asked Mr. Berger to give me this opportunity to speak, because I will be going back to the village tomorrow to begin the process of the declaration of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act as it applies to Unalakleet to be null and void. And hopefully this will put us on the way to resolving these questions which have plagued our people and our governments in dealing with not only the federal but also the state government. I would also like to express my appreciation not only to this commission for bringing these matters to light and studying them and their impact not only on the native people of Alaska, but also on indigenous peoples throughout the world. I have heard that the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act is being exported as a model settlement to be used as an example in the settlement of land claims of indigenous peoples throughout the world. And our actions will prove that the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act is in fact a model, sure, but it's a model of what not to do. And that will be the general thrust of not only my actions, but actions of our village council. I speak semi-officially in that regard, because I am a council member, and I will be informing the rest of our council that this, in fact, should be the course that we should be pursuing in our efforts, not only to become self-determining, self-governing, but also self-sufficient. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kachetag. Just before we move on, David Case had one or two questions for Alf Isaac Cascatallo.
Just as a point of reflection, when we broke last time, we just touched, I think, Mr. Cuscatello, on the migratory birds, or the hunting of migratory birds in, I'm not sure they're migratory, but in any event, birds in your area. And I guess should perhaps say for the record that that is a problem that is has long plagued Alaska natives as well, and I suspect Canadian Inuit and Indians, which stems, it's a problem that stems from, at least in these in the United States and Canada, from a treaty arrangement between the nation states regulating the migration of those birds, and the fact that the treaties provide, prohibit or severely restrict the hunting of birds in particularly the spring season, as I understand it, when the tradition is to hunt those species. And as in Norway, the approach in Alaska has, at least until recently, been to ignore the provisions of the treaties by the officials supposedly to enforce those treaties. But there's been some movement also to renegotiate the treaties and adopt other legislation in the United States to, in some measure, free up those restrictions. My question to you really goes back to something that Bill Erasmus was asking about. I guess the way I would frame it is, to what extent are Sami concerns about sovereignty associated with the exercise of jurisdictional control, actual direct political control over territories or people? Is that something that you foresee as a goal, or does it mean something else?
According to the question of jurisdiction, the Sami political program states, on the question of civil rights, that Sami civil rights are in full power in those areas in which Sami people comprise a majority. Such areas are to be established by an official list. Secondly, also in those areas in which Sami people have come to be a minority or are in a minority, Sami civil rights are to be preserved according to traditional principles. Then there is a list of what are to be considered main aspects of civil rights, concerning, for instance, education, language, and so forth. As you can see of the map that has been copied, it's a fact that in the largest portion of the traditional habitat, the Sami population is in a majority, and in some areas a very small a minority, and in some areas a very small minority even. It would probably be not feasible or even of no interest in trying to establish a sort of jurisdictional order in that area that collides with the local government of the Norwegian population in itself. What, however, is important is to gain protection of traditional land use, for instance, of areas belonging to traditional reindeer breeding. There have been suggestions, for instance, that reindeer breeders should have a veto in relation to industrial expansion and so forth. But in the majority population, such suggestions have aroused very strong opposition. But inevitably, Sami policy has to be directed at some sort of gaining a very strong type of protection for traditional land, even in the areas where the Sami population is in a small minority, in form of protection against expropriation and even some form of veto right, which could probably be assigned to the establishment of an elected Sami body to execute. Well, these are perspectives only, primarily, for the moment. As the political program expresses it, the situation is quite different in the majority areas, where there to some extent already is established political, local political control. But the problem is that the way local government can be executed within each community is strongly restricted by general laws on local government. And so far there is, for instance, no way in which a local community board or council is able to regulate the large against, for instance, encroachments upon the land. What could be foreseen is a development in the direction that in the majority areas the local form of government could be ascribed additional power, both in relation to regulate land use, to accept revenues for land use, and also to establish a sort of network to a common elected body. And this is one of the most of the complicated problems we have to think through and solve. That is notably, how is a Sami parliament to be connected to the already existing political steering process in the countries? How does it affect provincial government, local community government, also in relation to what proportion of the Sami population constitutes within each community or borough? These are very complicated problems, and on this point of development one can only foresee them and try to prepare to be able to solve them to some extent. But it's a definite aim of the Sami political program that political control is to be executed in some areas.
Daley Sambo, and then Charlie Edwardson.
I think that David asked the question that I wanted to ask, but only in a different manner. A point of clarification for my own purposes, do the Sami people, and I think Bill Erasmus was trying to elicit this earlier, do they, in terms of self-government, do they want to work within the existing framework of the governing bodies that now exist, or do they want to assert more sovereign self-government control of their own as more or less like a nation state versus one within the framework of already existing governments? And you somewhat answer that for me, but can you add to that, or?
Yes. Are you asking me?
Yes.
Yes. One must remember that There is a very long history behind this all. There is several hundred years of linking to the political system in the Nordic countries. The Sami communities, also the majority communities, have been working within the system of local government for a very long time. And there has not been much debate within those local political structures as to what should happen in relation to political reforms. But I can, for instance, say that my home community has made a very comprehensive general plan. It's a general plan that it is obliged to make. This community, where I come from, is the largest Sami community, both in area and in population. And the general plan expressly states that the aim of the Kuodagain community is to preserve the community as a secure base for the Sami population and preserve the land as a secure base for the traditional Sami economical system, and that any industrial development should be adjusted to those aims. Some of the other communities also have statements in such direction. It is a sort of distance between this local political process and the organizational Sami process. They are not identical. And as I said, there is going to be a considerable amount of debate on how the accustomed local government in the Sami areas is to be adjusted to the election, for instance, of a Sami parliament.